You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Harper Lee wrote the novel To Kill a Mockingbird in 1960. It became a bestseller and was made into a film in 1962. Later this year, there will be a new adaptation of the novel on Broadway, so To Kill a Mockingbird still has something to say to us in 2018. There are some who find the book, if not racist, at least insensitive. In an article in the New York Times, an African-American critic writes, "The N-word is used liberally throughout, and there are some breathtaking instances of both casual and outright racism. I am ambivalent because I am black. I don't need to read about a young white girl understanding the perniciousness of racism to actually understand the perniciousness of racism. I have ample first-hand experience." Well, this week, From the Bookshelf welcomes Tom Santopietro back to the show. One of our finest historians of popular culture, Tom Santopietro has written many books. His Sinatra in Hollywood is the defining volume on Frank Sinatra's acting career. He's also written biographies of Barbara Streisand and Doris Day, and he has published volumes on the films The Sound of Music and The Godfather Trilogy. Tom Santopietro is also an in-demand Broadway stage manager. His latest book is devoted to the novel and the film To Kill a Mockingbird, and it's called Why To Kill a Mockingbird Matters, What Harper Lee's Book and the Iconic American Film Mean to Us Today. Tom Santopietro, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, Gary, thanks very much for having me back on.
Your Godfather book elicited some new debate about the merits of Godfather Part 3, mostly between you and me, but your new book has stirred an altogether different sort of controversy. Did you know when you wrote this book that you were kicking a hornet's nest of race relations in the 21st century?
Oh, yes. I mean, that's a part of the package when it comes to discussing To Kill a Mockingbird. And I think particularly when placed in relief against Go Set a Watchman, published 50 years after Mockingbird, you know, this stirs up a lot of controversy and emotions, and I thought it was important to write about it.
And you do have a chapter in your book about whether or not it's racist. And that's such an interesting question that comes up again and again. I teach film history, and you're a film historian, and constantly people are looking at works from another time and judging them by our so enlightened 21st century minds. You know, they have difficulty accepting that things that can appear to be racist today had no racist intent or are not in fact racist.
Oh, I think absolutely. And I actually feel pretty strongly about it. It's just, you can't judge these works from the past by our standards today. You can use our standards today as a prism, but you can't judge, which is different. And when I was researching this, I came across a great phrase from a British historian who talked about, he called it the enormous condescension of posterity. And I really think you have to accept the works for what they are, place them in their time period, and then after that, you can look at them through today's viewpoint. But you can't only look at them from today's viewpoint.
I don't even think it's a new 21st century thing. I think it's something I remember in the 70s when we used to go to the movie theaters that showed older films. Those theaters don't exist anymore, mostly because of video. But in the pre-video days, there were movie houses that showed the old films that we love. And audiences would always giggle and laugh with condescension at what women were wearing or the things that they said.
Right, right. It's a tendency, because I think we all as human beings kind of think, oh, well, look how hip we are now and how evolved we are. But, you know, the flip side of that is 50 years from now, people will be doing the same thing about what we think in the year 2018. So I think it's most important to just look at the work itself. And it's what I wanted to do with both the novel of Mockingbird and also the film, because the film's such a big part of the Mockingbird's legacy.
Well, you know, there's a question I have about numbers, because you do give the numbers of how many copies of To Kill a Mockingbird sell every year, and it's a lot. But do you think more people have seen the movie than have read the book?
Oh, that's a great question. I actually don't know. I know the accepted figure for number of copies sold is that it's over 40 million now. And, you know, with if it was just theatrical release, I would say no, more people had read the book than the movie. But with home video now, it's kind of impossible to gauge. And I've talked to so many people who have talked about having three generations of their family watching the film together. Grandparent, parent, and child. And I think if you added all of them up, they'd probably be close to 40 million.
I noticed when you in your book, as you were talking about the, you sort of follow the lives of all of the main people after the movie. And that movie, even for somebody like Gregory Peck, who probably made, you know, 70 movies, that movie became the defining film for almost all the people, even to a certain extent, Robert Duvall, who just has a tiny non-speaking but important role in the film. And certainly for Mary Badham, the young girl who plays Scout in the film, that movie was a landmark for all of them.
Oh, absolutely, because that movie really holds up well. And I think it's for all of the people involved, it's a real high point in their film careers. And certainly for Peck, and Gregory Peck said, which it was such an interesting quote from him that I came across. He said this 30 years ago. He said, "I know the first line of my obituary will be Academy Award winner for To Kill a Mockingbird, and that's just fine with me." So he came to really embrace that identification with the role, and even his son started to refer to his father in terms of Atticus Finch, which I thought was very revealing and interesting.
And Mary Badham, the woman who played the little girl, calls him Atticus all the time, right?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. And I think it's because, and this is why I feel the book is important and the film is important, is that figure of Atticus Finch, you know, he represents the American we all want to be and that we think we maybe have within ourselves. You know, he's this, I call him the avatar of tolerance and justice and who does the right thing. And I think it's enormously appealing. He's an aspirational figure for us. And an aspirational American figure who nonetheless has resonated around the world because the book and the movie are so popular in other countries.
Now, I think it was your last book. We've talked about most of your books over the years. Was Sound of Music the one that came right before this one? I think it was.
Yes.
So in your Sound of Music book, you talked to many of the actors who played the children in the film and profiled them. And here you've profiled the children who were in this film. And almost all of these actors... Well, I guess one of them went on to a substantial film career, but most of them didn't, or the other two didn't. So how would you compare the experience of being a kid in The Sound of Music with a kid in this movie?
Well, I think they were life-defining for the children in both movies. I think the difference is that the children that were in The Sound of Music movie, they were thought of as a group of seven, and they realized over the years that that was their marketing tool. It was all seven of them together because everybody wanted to believe in that family. I think with in Mockingbird, you know, it's Jem and Scout, and then Dill is the Truman Capote figure, is the next-door neighbor. So it's more individualized, I would say, with Mockingbird.
There's also a parallel, I think, in the two films in that both of them deal with, you know, the controversy of hatred. And both of them have been criticized for how they deal with hatred and prejudice. That is, there's Nazis in The Sound of Music, but they seem, you know, pretty nice. And one of them is a little boy who used to have a crush on the little girl. And there's only one racist in the movie, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Well, right. I mean, I think that, and I understand that criticism of both, but I think, to me, I can overlook that because the heart of the story in both cases really comes through and speaks to the vast majority of people. And so I think both of those are cultural kind of totem poles that maybe the far left and the far right don't like, but that the vast majority in the middle really embrace. And, you know, with Mockingbird, it was fascinating to me how many people said that reading the book followed by watching the movie is what determined their life course to become attorneys. And very specifically, Morris Dees, you know, who's done such work battling prejudice. And he said it was seeing the Mockingbird movie that decided his life's course, which is just fascinating to me and a testament to the power that these pop culture icons, I'll call them, that they have.
We're talking with Tom Santapietro, and he's just written a new book, and it's called Why To Kill a Mockingbird Matters. And in your book, Tom, you talk a lot about Harper Lee and her life. Tell us a little bit about who she was and how she came to write this book.
Well, Harper Lee was a fascinating figure. And, you know, she grew up in Monroeville, Alabama, which in Mockingbird is disguised as Macomb. And the book was autobiographical. You know, she was very much like Scout when she was a little girl. She was a tomboy. Her father was an attorney just like Atticus, attorney A.C. Lee. And I think in terms of the autobiographical elements, what fascinates me about Harper Lee is she herself said, "I'm really Boo Radley." And there's a line in Mockingbird where Scout says, "I can stand anything but a bunch of people looking at me." And that was Harper Lee, and that she put that into the character of Boo Radley. So she's a combination of Scout and Boo Radley. And I think she wrote the book, which is so Southern and about her hometown, but she wrote it in New York City. And my phrase in the book was, she had to write her way out of her hometown.
So how old was she when she wrote the book?
The book came out in 1960, so she would have been just early 30s.
And she never published another one until she was in her 90s, I guess it was, or 80s.
Late 80s.
In your book, you talk about how she continuously talked about other books. What do you suppose happened?
Well, and that's part of the fascination with Harper Lee that so many people have, because here's this book that sold 40 million copies and there was never a follow-up until right before she died. I think it's really two things, and I did talk about this in the book because it's just so interesting to me. You know, somebody said she walked away from the Church of Fame, which is a very un-American thing to do. And I think the two reasons why were she had nowhere to go but down. She wrote a book that was beloved and won the Pulitzer Prize her first time out. And I think that's part of it. And I think the second part is, and this goes back to my answer about her being like Boo Radley, she did say she would never, ever go through again the sort of press attention that she had from Mockingbird. It really disrupted her life. She so disliked that attention. And I think you put those two elements together, and that's why the books she talked about never happened. And I had unearthed in my research, she had written a letter after Mockingbird came out to a good friend, and she talked about six different novels that she had planned, and we never saw those.
Do you think she did some writing but didn't publish it or what?
I actually don't think she did. I think the only other thing she did was go set a watchman. She did in the 1980s, and this again was a fascinating part of the story to me. She was working on a nonfiction book, which was about a reverend in the South who turned out to be a mass murderer. And she did a lot of research on the book and I believe had gone to the part of the South where he was from. And then she dropped it. And I don't know if it was the thought of publication or if she, you know, got too upset by the subject matter because, you know, this guy was really creepy. So, you know, again, it's the complexities of being a human being.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking to Tom Santopietro. His new book is called Why to Kill a Mockingbird Matters: What Harper Lee's Book and the Iconic American Film Mean to Us Today. Tom Santopietro, how long after Harper Lee wrote To Kill a Mockingbird did she sell it as a film?
Well, it was sold relatively soon after, but what had happened was that when it was, you know, these books get circulated in galleys and the Hollywood studios were completely uninterested in the book. They said, nobody cares about this story about a little girl in the 1930s in the South. But Alan Pakula, who was then a producer, and Robert Mulligan, the director, and they were business partners, they loved the book. Pakula read it first. And they pursued the rights. And even though they had no standing in Hollywood, they had made one film, so they didn't have power, Harper Lee and her sister Alice, an attorney who was her financial advisor, saw how much the two men loved the book, and they granted them the rights because they knew the book would be treated with such care and respect.
Pakula, of course, became a famous director later and directed all those sort of paranoid 70s movies. And you mentioned in the book that Mulligan was a really good director, but maybe had a less respect because he was not an auteur or he had a smaller body of work?
Yeah, I think you just answered that very well. I think it's both of those things. You know, the critical pantheon, if you're not who they consider an auteur, they sort of mark you down a peg. And he had a small body of work, but this guy was such an enormously sensitive director. And you see that in the way he handles the children in Mockingbird. They're really beautiful performances. And, you know, his last film, Mulligan's, was a kind of unknown film called Man in the Moon, which was with the very, very young Reese Witherspoon, her first film. And you see he handles her so well in that film. He was great with kids. And although he was an Irishman from the North, he gravitated to these stories set in the South because he loved that sense of neighborhood and tribalism and storytellers. And he that was in his bones.
In the film, you know, they deal with rape and other unsavory things, and that was still during the era of the production code. How did they get away with it?
Well, I think because it's never explicitly stated. There's a lot of subtext going on, and I think that's how they got away with it. And I think the fact that the book was so well known by the time the movie came out, the movie coming out in '62, 2 years after publication. So I think that's how they were able to get around it. And I think, you know, the film, if you look at the way they treat both that aspect and the that famous scene where Atticus has lost the trial defending Tom Robinson, and the African Americans in the balcony stand up in a show of respect for Atticus. That's the power of the film and why I think it got under people's skin. And that's not just the acting. That's how the film was shot and lit. And it really it gives you this sense, and this is why I think the book matters, of how all of us, every human being on the earth, as we grow from childhood into adolescence, we realize the world isn't black and white. It's 1,000 shades of gray. And what Scout and Jem learn, the way we all do, is that good people can do bad things, but do them for good reasons. And you realize how complicated the world is.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're talking with Tom Santopietro, who's the author of a new book called Why to Kill a Mockingbird Matters: What Harper Lee's Book and the Iconic American Film Mean to Us Today. Central to the success of the film To Kill a Mockingbird was its beautiful score by Elmer Bernstein. Although the score didn't win the Academy Award that year, it has proved to be a very memorable one. And let's listen to the main theme, Elmer Bernstein's To Kill a Mockingbird. Emma Bernstein's To Kill a Mockingbird, the score from the original 1962 film. We're talking with Tom Santopietro. He's the author of Why To Kill a Mockingbird Matters, What Harper Lee's Book and the Iconic American Film Mean to Us Today. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Tom Santopietro, in your new book, Why To Kill a Mockingbird Matters, you occasionally discuss the current state of the cinema, in which many of the movies that most people go see are movies that are really episodes in long-spanning sagas about superheroes or dinosaurs or that kind of thing.
Oh, yes, because I think what we're losing, these films are enormously popular, just what you said, you know, about superheroes, dinosaurs, but these aren't about real people. These are cartoon figures, you know, they're fantasy figures. And I think, to me, it's why Mockingbird, that film is about real people in a real recognizable time and place. And so I think the irony is that now, today, Hollywood does not really turn out very many movies about people, but television has picked up the slack, and I think we're, you know, through Netflix and Amazon, we're actually experiencing a golden age of storytelling on television, which is what we used to all denigrate as lacking quality. So I feel like it's all flipped upside down.
Wait a minute. What about the Beverly Hillbillies? That was... All right, never mind. I like that. That was one of my favorite shows.
I bet you can sing the theme song, too.
Oh, I could. and it was a contemporary of To Kill a Mockingbird, so...
I think that, you know, that year that the Mockingbird film came out, there were so many extraordinary films at that same time, films like Days of Wine and Roses and, you know, Manchurian Candidate and Who Shot Liberty Valance. You know, these are films that 50 years later still hold up so beautifully, and in Hollywood today, it's just so much harder to find that. They're all sort of kind of... Now the handful that are like that are released in December to try to qualify for Academy Awards.
I was watching Lawrence of Arabia on my phone the other day, and no, I'm just kidding.
was there a desert?
It's hard to tell. It's interesting that in the era that you mentioned, the movies that were the most popular movies were also the movies that won Academy Awards. And that's not really the case anymore. The movies that get nominated for the Academy Awards, with the exception of maybe Get Out last year, are not the movies that everybody is going to see.
No, that's absolutely right. And typically these films that have been recently winning Best Picture, you know, they gross maybe $40 million at the theater, which is the opening day box office for one of the superhero movies. But back with Mockingbird, you know, which won 3 Oscars and was enormously popular, you know, the best picture was Lawrence of Arabia, which was enormously popular. So there was much more of a correlation between the popularity and the award winners.
Okay, so does that mean that people had better taste then? We're just old farts and we don't like the things that kids like?
Well, Well, I plead guilty to being old now, no question. No, I mean, it's not at all a question of taste. It's what we're offered by the Hollywood studios, and they're all so scared of losing money and really of losing their jobs that their eye now is not at all on a story about real people. It's about, is this a film that can play overseas in, you know, 40 different languages where it doesn't as long as they see flashy visuals, it'll be popular. And I think that's how the thinking has changed, because in the golden age of Hollywood, you know, everybody has this caricature of Louis B. Mayer and Sam Goldwyn and the moguls like that, but those men loved movies. They wanted to be successful, but they loved film. And my own feeling today is in Hollywood, those executives mostly love the art of the deal.
Well, you've been a stage manager for dozens of Broadway shows, and over the years, is it similar? What's happening on Broadway? Are Broadway shows more flashy, less? Do they tend not to address the small ideas?
Well, I think on Broadway right now, it's interesting because on the one hand, we're inundated with adaptations of popular movies. You know, Frozen was just turned into a Broadway musical, and the popular Nickelodeon series SpongeBob was turned into a Broadway musical. But at the same time, the shows that have won all the top awards and are popular are very individualistic, quirky shows, like Dear Evan Hansen and this year The Band's Visit. So you really do get both, which I think is great. I mean, you know, I think it's great that, you know, Phantom of the Opera speaks to so many people, and at the same time that something like Dear Evan Hansen is addressing a serious topic in a very entertaining and kind of thought-provoking fashion.
And what about Frozen? Is it any good? Have you seen it?
I have not yet seen Frozen, so I shouldn't venture an opinion.
I was watching the Tonys, and that costumed reindeer looks amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, enormously appealing to kids, and my attitude always is A, it's great to see people employed, and B, if it appeals to kids and gets them excited about theater, and that develops into a real interest in theater and film, I'm all for it.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking to Tom Santapietro. His new book is called Why to Kill a Mockingbird Matters: What Harper Lee's Book and the Iconic American Film Mean to Us Today. Tom Santapietro, your new book, About to Kill a Mockingbird, goes into some detail about the casting of Atticus Finch, who was, of course, played by Gregory Peck, and it's hard for us to imagine anybody but the Oscar-winning Gregory Peck in the role, but there were a lot of interesting possibilities, including Bing Crosby.
Right, Bing Crosby's name was mentioned at one point. The first one came from Harper Lee, and she said, I can only see one man playing Atticus Finch, and that is Spencer Tracy. And that's a really interesting idea. He would have been a little old, but, you know, he had already played attorneys in several popular films. And he could have done it. And she wrote him a letter and said, you know, I would love to see you play the role. And he wrote back and said, or through his agent, said, I'm making the movie Devil at 4 o'clock with Frank Sinatra right now. I can't even think about To Kill a Mockingbird. So the idea went nowhere.
And having written about Sinatra and watched all of his films, did he make the right decision? Which would have been a better picture?
Oh, I think we all know the answer to that. Devil at 4 o'clock was not the finest hour for either Frank or Spencer Tracy. It's sort of good for the first 20 minutes.
Plays a priest?
He's really a convict. It just falls apart. And I think it's just too bad Spencer Tracy didn't consider it. But, you know, the right man played the role. And I had this great interview for the book with a woman with the terrific Southern name of Bodie Boatwright. and she cast the roles of the kids in the film. It was like a nationwide search.
She traveled around the country looking for these kids.
Yeah, yeah. She traveled all through the South. And we talked about the casting of the kids, and at the same time she talked about Gregory Peck, and she said, you know, Bing Crosby was mentioned, Spencer Tracy was mentioned, and then Bodhi said, but absolutely the right man played the role, because there were similarities between Peck the man and the character of Atticus Finch.
Yeah, they could make it now. Dwayne Johnson is available. He'd be great.
Right. Or Steven Seagal.
He's dead. But, of course, there is a new To Kill a Mockingbird, and it's coming to Broadway, and it's written by Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah, I'm actually very much looking forward to that. I think Aaron Sorkin has a really different take on it. Nobody's seen it, but from the details that have been released, it sounds like he's taking the Atticus Finch from Ghost at a Watchman and showing him morph into the Atticus Finch we all know and love from To Kill a Mockingbird. And that's a really interesting idea to me, that sort of combination. And I think he's having adults play the kids' role, and he's building up the role of Calpurnia, the African-American housekeeper. And my feeling is that with material as strong as Mockingbird is, it can take on these different interpretations. And my hope is the play will speak to audiences in the year 2018 and give the novel and the film yet more life.
It opens in December, I believe.
Yes, that's right.
I want to see it. I think it'd be great. I love Aaron Sorkin's work. I think he's really one of the great screenwriters.
Oh, he's a terrific writer, and Jeff Daniels, who's a very good actor, is playing Atticus Finch, so I think that's an interesting idea. And, you know, it's just hard for us to get the image of Gregory Peck out of our minds. It's just so indelible. And, you know, also Alan Pakula had this quote where he said, in a very understated fashion, he said, "I must say the man and the character are not unalike." And I think that's why it worked so well on film.
Well, we talked earlier. I was mentioning The Godfather 3, how I thought it was terrible, and you found much merit in it. And then when Ghost at a Watchman came out, I sort of didn't read it. I haven't read it, and I thought, well, you know, I love To Kill a Mockingbird, and I don't want there to be anything else. And you talk about it extensively in your book, and you even mentioned that Maureen Corrigan of Fresh Air claimed that it seemed to her as though it were not a prequel but a sequel, or not an earlier version. So what's the real story?
Well, the real story is it's the first version, very different, of To Kill a Mockingbird. And Harper Lee herself, I think, summed it up the best. She called it the parent of Mockingbird. And so Ghost at a Watchman, you know, was submitted as a novel. And Harper Lee's editor, a really smart woman named Tay Hohoff, whom Harper Lee memorably characterized as the Quaker Hitler, Tay Hohoff said, "You know what? You have a real voice. You have a real talent. I find myself drawn to the sections with Scout as a child. Concentrate on that." And so that's how Mockingbird grew into the story of Scout as a young girl, whereas when you read Ghost at a Watchman, it's two-thirds Scout as a grown woman and one-third Scout as a young girl.
And is it any good?
Oh, well, it's certainly not Mockingbird. And my big take on Ghost at a Watchman is that when I read it, because I've read it closely twice now, and there is, it's almost like two books in one, because the sections where Scout is a little girl, the plot of Ghost at a Watchman is she's now Jean Louise Finch. She goes back to her hometown for a 3-day visit. It's in the 1950s. And while she's there, part of it is a recollection of her childhood. And all the sections set in the childhood years have this beauty and ease of language. It's like Harper Lee felt that so strongly. And then all the sections with Jean Louise, you know, grown up coming back, that's where the book doesn't work for me. It just seems very kind of lots of clunky exposition. And so while people fixated on the fact that Atticus is a racist in Go Set a Watchman, I was much more struck by how the writing, it just seemed so, as I said, like two books in one. And that's, I think, where I'm glad it was published, but that's why it's not nearly as good a book for me.
In your book, you mentioned some of the other authors who are renowned for having written one really great book and maybe nothing else. I mean, there's Salinger, who wrote many things, but he only wrote one novel. And there's Ross Lockridge Jr., you talk about him, who wrote Raintree County, which is like an incredibly great book. It's kind of forgotten now, but it's great. So I guess maybe that's really who Harper Lee was.
Yeah, and Ralph Ellison is another one, although Juneteenth was published after he died, you know, in a kind of heavily revised version. But I think in part it was who Harper Lee was. I think she wanted to write something else, but when I was saying what I was saying earlier about the, I think the press attention just bothered her so much, and she talked about, so she never did another interview after 1964, never did an in-depth interview. And, you know, she talked about the fact that the day, it's almost like, although she didn't say it to me, I thought, oh, that's the day the switch clicked, that Mockingbird was becoming so popular. And one day she received 60 letters in the mail with requests, you know, can you answer these questions? Can you send me a signed book? Can you come here and talk? And she just thought, that's it. I cannot do this. And, so, you know, that's the Boo Radley part of her. She was not a total recluse by any stretch. You know, she lived most of the year in New York City, where she could be anonymous. But she would spend the winter months back in her hometown, where people knew to let her go about her business. And when, you know, the Mockingbird fans would come asking about her, they would deliberately give wrong directions so that Harper Lee could maintain her privacy. But it's who she was. And it's part of the fascination for all of us.
Well, your book, the subtitle, What Harper Lee's Book and the Iconic American Film Mean to Us Today, you're a man, and you're a white guy. So are you allowed to tell us what this book means?
I'm certainly allowed to say what it means to me, and by means of extrapolation what it could mean to other people, and it's why I make a point, you know, this whole issue of who's entitled to write what. I just think you can't tell an artist what to write, any creative person, and because it, you know, the premise of art to me is universality, trying to understand each other, which is the premise of Mockingbird when Atticus says you can't know another person until you walk around in his skin. And it's why I wanted to quote James Baldwin, who is one of the greatest writers of the 20th century. And he was talking about this very issue in terms of his friend William Styron, who received such enormous criticism for writing Confessions of Nat Turner. And James Baldwin said, I understand both sides of, you know, this debate, but you can't tell somebody what to write. And then, and he said this back in 1967, what was fascinating is he used the words that were almost from Mockingbird, even though he was not referencing Mockingbird, and he said, I admire William Styron enormously for making the effort to step into somebody else's skin. And I just thought, wow, that's James Baldwin saying that. And he's truly a great writer.
Well, I really love this book, Why To Kill a Mockingbird Matters. What made you decide to write it now?
I think it's a book and a movie I've always loved, and it just seemed to me, it's been sort of niggling in the back of my brain. And then, given what has been happening in the country, in terms of the racial situation and racial animus in our country. I think that was another part of the puzzle for me, why I wanted it to come out now. And it's, you know, the events in Charlottesville last year were so upsetting to me that was another impetus. You know, all these little pieces come together to push you towards writing this particular story at a certain time.
Well, Gregory Peck's character in the movie, he's like the president.
I wish he were the president. He's been so enormously appealing.
It's interesting how our vision of a president is changing.
It certainly is, and I think, you know, what makes Atticus so appealing and seemingly presidential to me is when there's the discussion about why is he, you know, why are you defending Tom Robinson from this trumped-up charge of rape, and with the whole town basically arrayed against Atticus, and when he says, because if I don't, I couldn't hold my head up high and could never tell you, my children, how to live your lives. I just thought, oh my gosh, that's what we want today. It's what, you know, I think there's such a sense of that lacking today. And again, speaking in terms of both presidents, which was your question, and why I think it matters, you know, President Obama, it was just days before he left office, and he gave a speech, and he referenced Atticus and To Kill a Mockingbird. And he talked about, he said, if we're going to have any hope as a country, we would do well to pay attention to the words of Atticus Finch, one of the great characters of American fiction. And then he quoted the speech about, you never know another person until you step inside his skin and walk around for a while. And just watching President Obama say that, you know, and who hosted a 50th anniversary screening of the film in the White House, I thought, for me, that's why it still matters today.
What are you going to set your sights on next? What's next for Tom Santopietro?
I have a book sort of in the back of my brain right now, but I think what's next immediately for me is I like to do new things and challenge myself, and I think after working in the theater for all these years, I've written a play, and I'm going to see what happens with that.
Well, I know a guy, he's a stage manager, maybe I can get him to you don't want to say anything about your play, about what it's about?
It's too early yet. I've been working actually on two different plays because I really wanted to try something completely new. You know, the worst that happens is I fall on my face and fail, and then, you know, you just pick yourself up and try again. One of the plays is really big and sprawling, and one is very, very small. And the small one, there seems to be interest from a theater, not in New York, but a full Equity theater. And I thought, oh, this would be great. It'll give me a chance to see it on its feet and whether it's any good or sends the audience fleeing from the theater. You know, I'll find out.
Is there a reindeer in it? This new book is called Why To Kill a Mockingbird Matters, What Harper Lee's Book and the Iconic American Film Mean to Us Today, and the author, the brilliant Tom Santopietro. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, Gary, thanks so much for having me on. It's a terrific show, and thanks for allowing me to be a part of it.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Tom Santopietro. His new book is called Why To Kill a Mockingbird Matters, What Harper Lee's Book and the Iconic American Film Mean to Us Today. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.